I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today we're getting out of the city a bit to talk about food, how we grow it, and what we make out of it. First, the slow food movement is an idea, a way of living, and a way of eating that emphasizes foods that are healthy for you and for the planet. It promotes environmentally and socially responsible eating. Josh Viertel is the first president of Slow Food USA, and he joined us to talk about the story behind the food we eat. And we'll also talk with Pete Nelson about growing opportunities to turn farm products into fuel and other materials, connecting the farm to the city through biotechnology. All that, plus the latest news from PlanEtizen and our City Views commentator Walker Smith coming up on today's Smart City right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. In 1986, McDonald's opened its first restaurant in Rome. The response was the slow food movement. Slow food is a political movement, an educational organization, and a cultural force that advocates for the pleasures of the table. Here in the U.S., the movement took form as Slow Food USA, which has just announced its first president, my guest, Josh Viertel. Josh, what is slow food?
It's food that's good for people. It's good for the environment. It's good for the people who grow it, good for the people who eat it. And we say it's food that's good, clean, and fair.
Good, clean, and fair. Tell me about fair.
When we say good, clean, and fair, the last word fair is really important to us. And it means both that everyone can have access to it, and it means that the people who grow it and the people who pick it are given wages that are fair and are treated with dignity.
Is there any evidence that the consumption of fast food is slowing down?
That's a good question. There's evidence that consumption of slow food is increasing, is speeding up. But at the same time, I think that food really at the bottom in terms of good, clean, and fair food, the worst food, more and more people are eating it in this time because it's really cheap. So we're in this funny time. The economy has driven both sides of the scale. So on the one hand, people are looking for the cheapest food they can find. On the other, people are eating out a little bit less in some cases, and they're also looking for a really authentic, simple experience. So people are buying whole ingredients. They are canning, they're gardening more than they ever have before. So we're seeing some really good trends, too.
It's interesting. Like most trends, I guess, you have two contrary things happening at once. Do fast food companies consider you the enemy?
I'm not sure that they really consider us right now. I think they're very focused on rapidly expanding their model. And we're really focused on proposing another model. And so far, we haven't directly engaged companies and said that they're bad and argued with them. Instead, we really seduced consumers. And so what's happening is the market share that represents good, clean, fair food, I think, is growing pretty substantially. And over time, it might come to a pitched battle. But for now, I see us as really just pushing for something really good rather than directly fighting something bad.
You say that your mission is to create dramatic and lasting change in the food system. What changes do you seek?
Well, there's one really particular change we're working on right now, which is a change in the way that public school lunch works. We're in the middle of a campaign called Time for Lunch, and there's a piece of legislation called the Child Nutrition Act, which has to pass by the end of September or be extended. And we're advocating that Congress rewrite that bill in a way that will make it possible for schools to give real food to the kids who are there. And that means increasing the reimbursement rate. Right now, schools have less than a dollar a day to buy ingredients for lunch, which is just absurd. Schools right now, you might be surprised to know, they're selling food that meets no dietary guidelines. They're not held to any standard for all of the what they call competitive foods, the vending machine foods and a la carte stuff. And last time this bill was passed, there was money that was supposed to be in it for farm-to-school programs, so schools could really be an engine for the local economy by buying local produce. And that money in the end was never released, and there was money in there to help schools get competitive grants around setting up gardens so that kids could learn where their food comes from. We're pushing basically to make that bill better so that 30 million kids every day in America's public schools, poorest kids in the country, can eat real food, can know where their food comes from, and can be protected from fast food and vending machine companies that are selling them food right now that makes them sick.
Now, a lot of schools make money off of those vending machines. That provides, I guess, an important source of income, right?
That's an interesting assumption. In some cases, that's true, but there have been some really strong studies out there that show when schools actually have healthy offerings, they can generate other revenue streams, and in some cases break even, in other cases come out ahead. So it's a false assumption that if schools stop selling sugary sodas, that they're going to lose a revenue stream. There are a lot of instances where actually by doing the right thing, they end up replacing that revenue stream with selling the right thing, or with making other costs go away.
Is what you're calling for, Time for Lunch, is this like a sea change in what schools are doing?
It is. Right now, you go into a public school and kids are eating tater tots, they're eating pizza pockets, they're eating food that most parents would recognize as food that's not good for their kids. And the schools don't really have a choice because of the federal policy that governs school lunch. And we want to radically change that so schools can power their local economy with local purchasing, so kids can grow up having eaten food that makes them healthy and also having had their minds stimulated by learning about where food comes from, by growing it themselves. And when I think about what those kids will do when they grow up, I think that it's an incredible investment, particularly if you contrast it with where they're headed right now, where 1 in 3 kids under the age of 9 is going to get diabetes, 1 in 2 in African American and Hispanic communities. And you think about the cost, the human cost, but also the financial cost. Right now, we spend $146 billion a year on treating diet-related disease alone. Now, when those chickens come home to roost and those kids grow up and 1 in 3 in our population has diabetes, which is totally preventable, the cost financially will be enormous. And you think about the lost cost to our productivity as a nation, also enormous. So this is really a radical departure from a policy right now that's really making our kids sick.
You said that part of your aim is to seduce consumers into the slow food movement. What is it really that attracts people to the movement?
I think people want to be connected with their place and with an authentic experience. People get really excited when they go to farmers markets. Little kids intuitively get really excited when the first time they pull a carrot and they look down and see that carrot come out of the ground. It's just intuitively a really engaging experience. And people are searching for that more and more. You look at these trends that we're seeing now, more people are canning than ever before. It's hard to find mason jars. Ball, the company that makes them, is in short supply right now because so many people are canning this season. Garden supply centers are running out of seeds because people are gardening at a rate they never have before. And I think that's because it's something people, especially now when so much of our life experience turns out to have been based on a shaky foundation of bad credit, that people want something real.
A lot of people feel like they don't have time for slow food because life is fast. What is the relevance to them?
Well, there's an enormous amount of flexible time in our lives that we make choices about all the time. And I think about the president right now. President Obama is probably one of the busier guys around, and he's making a point to carve out a little bit of time to sit down with his family and share a meal together. And the First Lady's doing the same, I think.
But they have a cook. Come on.
Yeah, they do have a cook.
In other words, if I had a cook, I think it would be great to engage in the slow food movement. But, I mean, you're right. They are at least sitting down as a family, and he is, yes, a busy guy.
He could be eating a wrap in the back of a limo on the way to a meeting, and instead he's sitting down with his family. I think that's a really good lesson.
I agree with that. But cooking, for many of us, is really a lost art. I mean, people don't know how to cook. So how do you get them engaged in this movement that not only do you have to go to the local farmers market, which is lots of fun, but then you've got to figure out what to do with this stuff that you bought?
Absolutely. You know, I go to the farmers market every week, and I don't spend a lot of time there because I'm a really busy guy, like a lot of people who are working in this country right now. And I find that I blast through it, but I get to have a lot of really good human interactions with the people I meet there. I buy whatever's in season, which means it's cheaper. I take a little time on Sunday to carve out and cook a lot of food, and I generally eat that throughout the week. And I try to have friends over for dinner instead of going out to see a movie, or instead of going out to a restaurant together, we'll have a dinner party. And at that dinner party, you're cooking beautiful food and everyone raves about it. But if you break it down, I'm cooking dinner for 10 friends for less than it would cost to take them out and get them all a Happy Meal.
Josh, you have a similar program to Slow Foods in Schools, a program on college campuses. What kind of impact are you having there?
Well, college students are pushing to get real food on their college campuses, too. And that ranges from getting food that's local, that's seasonally grown, that is sustainable, to food that is picked by workers who get fair wages. So there's a campaign in partnership with the Student Farm Workers Alliance to get the food service management companies, which run a lot of our college dining halls, to sign on to an agreement that says they're going to pay fair wages to their workers. So it's around fairness. It's around sustainability. It's around powering the local economy. But then they're also doing really interesting work in their communities. Some are setting up gardens in public schools to do education for younger kids in that community. Others are setting up farms or gardens on their own campus. And then some are doing events that just get people really excited about these issues. One of my favorites was at UNC at Chapel Hill. A local college student partnered up with the Slow Food chapter and threw a big party, a whole hog roast with a locally raised pastured pig that they roasted and had all their friends eating together and playing music. But then they had a worker from the Smithfield plant, which is a hog processing plant just down the road from the college, where the vast majority of pork consumed in this country is eaten, and where workers are treated miserably. And they had this worker who had been organizing at Smithfield come and give a testimony about what the conventional pork slaughtering system was like and how different it was from the pork they were eating. So it was a combination of talking about fairness for people, talking about humane treatment of animals, talking about sustainability, talking about local economies, but at the same time, it was a party.
You even have a program documenting endangered food. It was not a term I had heard before. What is endangered food?
So we used to have thousands of varieties of apples in this country, and now there are really, depending on how you count it, between 5 and 9 that are produced commercially and shipped. So there's this huge loss of biodiversity in our food system. And our local chapters are working to find these lost varieties and also these lost traditions and to preserve them and say, hey, these are things that taste wonderful. They're also varieties that are endemic to our place and have grown up with our place. So they are native to this spot, which means that it's easier to grow them in a sustainable way here. And there are also these food traditions that have grown up around them that have held our community together. So let's try to preserve or renew those traditions.
You mentioned apples. Are there foods today that we're eating that we're familiar with that are at risk of disappearing?
Well, that's a really interesting question. On some level, yes, in that so much of our food system is homogenous. So much of the food we eat is produced in a monocrop, and the number of varieties are very few, sometimes just one. And so one pathogen, one disease can wipe out a national crop. You look at turkeys right now, and the vast majority of the turkeys we eat are this one variety called broad-breasted white. And the broad-breasted white is grown and bred to have a really big breast, because that's what people like to eat. It's so large that we need to artificially inseminate these birds. I don't know if this is okay for the radio, but they can't mount each other physically because their breasts are so big. And it's one variety all over the country, and one pathogen that breed, which is heavily inbred, is susceptible to, could really wipe out the entire turkey population in the country. So we're working to preserve these other heritage varieties like the slate and the bourbon red that were great American poultry varieties that now are at risk of extinction because they're not part of the market. We're both doing it because we think they taste really good and because it supports local farmers and because they're cool, but also because, man, we think that there should be a little bit of diversity in the food system. So if something goes wrong, we're not all stuck with nothing to eat.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Josh Viertel, the first president of Slow Food USA. We're talking about the slow food movement and how certain ideas from the movement, such as eating locally, have permeated the popular culture. 10 years ago, slow food seemed like an unlikely concept to become popular, and yet it has become popular. You have the first lady planting a vegetable garden and shopping at the local farmers market. How do you explain that?
Well, I think it's a good idea whose time has come. People want a real connection with each other, with their community, with the food they eat, and that's a really natural thing. It's really only in the last 60 years when we've lost that connection. And people are drawn to it. At the same time, we're seeing these four major crises in this country: crisis around climate, crisis in our public education, financial crisis, and the health crisis. Each of those four crises are deeply connected to the food we eat and the way it's produced. So you can't deal with climate change, with the economic meltdown. You can't deal with public education. You can't deal with healthcare, certainly, without dealing with the food we eat, the farms that produce it. So people are starting to make this connection and be drawn together around the simple idea that the food you eat has a story behind it, and it should be a story that you believe in.
What does success look like for Slow Food?
I can imagine a world where it's completely normal for people to cook food from scratch and share it with their family, where that happens every day. I can imagine a public education system where schools have traded in their metal detectors and their dead cement lots for vibrant living gardens where they're teaching kids what food is and where it comes from. I can imagine a world where there are no more parents who are struggling with this question of whether their kids will eat food that they know is going to make them sick or whether they'll eat at all, which is what the poorest parents in our country who are sending their kids to public school are stuck thinking about right now. And I can imagine a world where those kids grow up to do really good work in the world and they're healthy. And I think that that's what success looks like for us. It's really a world where everyone can eat food that's good for them, that's good for the people who grow it, that's good for the environment, and it tastes good too.
What are the biggest challenges you face in realizing success?
I think the biggest challenge is how consolidated power is in our food system right now. There are really two crops that are in all the food that we eat, vast majority of it. They're corn and soybeans. And there's really three companies that control the vast majority of the way those products move around. They're Cargill, Archer Daniels Midland, and ConAgra. One company controls the vast majority of the seed for soybeans and corn. That company's Monsanto. And so power is extraordinarily consolidated. And when that happens, legislators become beholden to that power. And so it becomes really hard to change the laws that govern the way food works in this country. And I think that's the biggest challenge, is how we dismantle that. And what I'm finding is happening is that a movement's emerging nationally that is saying, that's not okay with us. It's not okay to have food in our public schools that makes our kids sick. We need policy that is different. And we don't really care